we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
This is the regime change crew. They're back in town, they're ascendant, and it sounds very much like that is what President Trump is hoping for.
Britain has no intention of walking away.
From Tehran, we turn to Brussels and Federica Mogherini, the European Union's high representative for foreign affairs and security.
The deal not only will hold, but the deal doesn't belong to one country or another. It's a UN Security Council resolution, and the entire international community, from Russia to China to Japan to Latin America to Europe and the European Union, will continue to guarantee that the deal will hold, is implemented, and that Iranians will continue to stick to their nuclear commitments.
In words that could have been spoken yesterday, France's most illustrious post-war leader, Charles de Gaulle, said, and I quote, "You may be sure that the Americans will commit all the stupidities they can think of, plus some that are beyond imagination." The Trump administration's unconscionable decision to withdraw from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal was just such an act of stupidity beyond imagination. Not only has it pushed the Middle East to the very precipice of a full-scale regional conflict, it calls into question Washington's reliability and credibility when it comes to the process of peace, reconciliation, and normalization currently underway on the Korean Peninsula. How can the North Korean leadership possibly be expected to trust Washington now? The obvious answer is that it cannot. Indeed, who can? Certainly not Europe, where just weeks after current French President Emmanuel Macron was prancing around like the son of Napoleon, boasting of the influence he wields over Trump when it comes to Syria, the transatlantic alliance is to all intents in tatters, or at least it should be after Washington threatened to introduce sanctions against British, French, and German companies operating in Iran. It is high time that Europe woke up to Washington's regressive role in its affairs. For if the Trump administration's demarche against the Iranians, involving the implicit demand that Europe follow suit, if it proves anything, it is that the transatlantic alliance is a sham. It is not, and never has been, an alliance of equal partners and friends, as its supporters fatuously opine. It is instead a relationship between an imperial hegemon and its European satellites. Everything from the free market, neoliberal economic model that has sown such discord and despair, which gave us in 2008 the worst global economic crisis since the 1930s, to the worst relations between Russia and Europe since at any time since the Cold War. In fact, since at any time including the Cold War, Washington's involvement in Europe has been inordinately malign, impeding the continent's development and progress. As such, the time has come for Europe to liberate itself from US domination and step out into the world as a truly independent region, unencumbered by slavish subservience to a US hegemonic agenda, one which, as the empirical evidence leaves no doubt, is the definitive root cause of conflict, instability, and tensions in the world today. Thus, in the wake of the crisis over Iran, Europe now has a choice. It can choose to remain tethered to the mast of the sinking ship of unipolarity, or it can join Russia and China in forging a multipolar alternative, one rooted not in the caprice of a US president in Washington, but instead in the principles set out in the UN Charter, specifically respect for national sovereignty, self-determination, and international law. Returning to Charles de Gaulle, "It is Europe," he said, "from the Atlantic to the Urals. It is the whole of Europe that will decide the fate of the world." I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Jan Oberg is a professor of peace studies and research, and he's the director of Transnational Foundation for Peace and Future Research, TFF. And he joins me now. Jan, welcome to Hard Facts.
Thank you very much. Hello from Sweden.
Now, the implications of Trump's unilateral withdrawal from the Iran deal are enormous. I don't think they can be overstated. For example, when I looked at the picture of US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo smiling at the camera in the company of North Korea's Kim Jong-un, having given him an assurance of America's goodwill and good intentions towards peace and reconciliation on the Korean Peninsula, a chill slid down my spine. Surely no one, much less the North Koreans, could possibly trust the word of Washington now.
Yes, of course, there's a link between all these nuclear issues. And the biggest link of them all is that it's always the countries which have hundreds of nuclear weapons who are telling others not to have it. I mean, this whole debate is bizarre because, you know, nuclear weapons is the worst weapons humanity has ever had. And those who are the haves are telling the have-nots to not acquire them. This in itself is a total violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which clearly stated that in exchange for those abstaining from getting nuclear weapons, those who have nuclear weapons should in good faith abolish them through negotiations. So that's the framework of the whole thing. When it comes to Iran, the framework is also that Iran does not have nuclear weapons. The only one in the Middle East that has nuclear weapons is Israel, and nobody talks about those weapons, which are much more dangerous than non-existing Iranian ones. And third, the JCPOA, the nuclear deal with Iran from July 2015, is a fabulous piece of diplomacy. It will be read about in every book on diplomacy in the future, as a textbook example of how you, through goodwill on all sides and very asymmetric relations, Iran went out of any reasonable limit because it wanted the sanctions to be lifted and because, in my view, it does not want nuclear weapons, to please to make a step for peace in the Middle East and the world. And it is in those three perspectives, in my view, we should see how absolutely unacceptable, reckless and, you know, meaningless this step by the United States is, both vis-a-vis Iran, which of course cannot say that it can trust the U.S. anymore, and it hasn't done so since 1953 with the CIA coup d'etat against Dr. Mossadegh, the first democratically elected prime minister of Iran. And secondly, it's offensive, to say the least, against all those other countries who are members who have signed this agreement. And I'm glad so far that everybody else on that bottom line with signatures have said we stand by the deal with Iran because, you know, it's embedded in, it's integrated into international law because it's the United Nations Security Council resolution too. So the United States just violates again and again international law and psychologically, of course, posing as one you cannot trust anymore. I would see it as I've also written in one of the press infos from our foundation, I would see it as something that will turn into, already is in principle, a declaration of war on Iran. And it's very, very sad for the whole world. And it's not the rest of the world who are isolated by the U.S. It's the U.S. that is isolating itself. And that in itself is dangerous when an empire is on its way down, to isolate itself and become more and more desperate into a corner. And the only thing they're really good at now is military.
Well, everything you've just said, Jan, I agree with wholeheartedly, especially the end when you talk about the US as a declining empire. I've made this point on the show before that what we are seeing is an empire in its dying days. Maybe when I say dying days, I'm speaking figuratively. I'm not saying it's going to decline in a year, 2 years, even decades, but it's certainly on the downward slide. Its influence economically, culturally, geopolitically has diminished as Russia and China emerges counterweights as an anti-hegemonic bloc in all but name. I endorse a formation of this bloc, an expansion of this bloc to take on a more a formal character involving North Korea, involving Iran, involving Syria and Venezuela, in short, all the countries that find themselves in the crosshairs of US imperialism. And when you say that this Iran deal and this unilateral withdrawal by Washington has been done not to effect any kind of stability, not to increase the chances of peace in the Middle East, it is tantamount to a declaration of war. This move, this demarche on the part of the Trump administration was effected in the interests and at the behest of the neocon establishment in Washington, which now has full grip of US foreign policy under his administration, in conjunction with US regional allies, Israel and Saudi Arabia. This is, to all intents, an access of sectarianism and chaos in our time, isn't it?
Yes and no. I mean, I don't know how much of a geostrategic theoretician you are. I am not. I think that, you know, polarization and confrontation is not very helpful. I would ask the question in this situation, who, if anyone, can persuade the United States to behave themselves? And I would say it must be the allies and friends in Europe, in the NATO alliance and in the European Union. I'm not expecting Saudi Arabia and Israel to teach or to put pressure on the U.S. to reinstall the agreement again or something like that, or signature again in the agreement. But what I think one must think of now, which I find a fascinating thought, you know, Gandhian civil resistance, disobedience, is something that should now be practiced by governments who are friends of the United States. Simply, you know, we're not, one, following you. Two, we may have set up sanctions against you. Three, we will call up your ambassadors in our countries and give them some hard talk. Third, you know, we might contemplate closing down some of the bases that you have in Europe, because we have to find our own new way of defending Europe and ourselves and security politics and peace politics. My great worry, having said that, is, of course, that capacity for independent thinking, that civil courage which is needed by European and other leaders to do that vis-a-vis Washington, it may not be strong enough. I mean, I'm born in Denmark. I've lived more than 40 years in Sweden. I've seen how much of the security thinking is done, you know, in obedience to his master's voice in Washington. There's been very little independent capacity for research that goes out of the framework. I think basic countries in Europe are taken with their, you know, I wouldn't say their pants down, but you know what I mean. They've not even thought of since 45 that we might have to stand on our own and not just listen to or navigating in relationship to Washington's policies and proposals and ideas. And that lack of, you know, independent research capacity, that dependence of foreign ministries, that dependent on military technology with the defense ministries of the U.S., it has been far too easy for the U.S. to bully even friends over all these decades, because they were good at it. They were a leadership nation. They were an innovative nation. They were something that Europe looked up to. And now the whole thing is falling apart.
Jan, if I can just stop you there, I'm afraid we've run right up to the break. Hold that thought. You're listening to Jan Oberg. This is Hard Facts. We'll be right back.
We have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard Facts.
Welcome back to the second half of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down in the company of Jan Oberg from Sweden, Professor of Peace Studies and Research and Director at the Transnational Foundation for Peace and Future Research. Jan, you were elaborating on the course of action that the rest of the world must take in response to the increasingly out-of-control juggernaut, which is Washington, in its impulsive and capricious actions on the world stage. Can I just make myself clear on something, Jan? I'm not advocating, when I talk about the formation of an anti-hegemonic bloc, I'm not advocating war, not for a second.
No, I know.
But I think it's an absolute, inarguable fact that force only, power concedes nothing without a demand, and the only equals can reach agreement and only the strong can compromise. And the longest period of peace we've had in modern history was between the Second World War up to now. I'm talking about in terms of global conflagrations. And that was because of the Soviet bloc and its ability to render the US the same kind of damage that it could render the Soviet bloc. People have the right to defend themselves. And you mentioned Gandhian principles of civil resistance on an international scale, but I just draw your attention to the fact that implicit within those principles is the moral rectitude of your adversary, that he will respect and abide by the same moral framework upon which you are operating in undertaking that tactic of civil disobedience. And I draw your attention in this regard, sadly, to events in Gaza, where the Palestinians are being mown down like deer in a forest by soldiers of the IDF, and they are unarmed demonstrators. I just wonder if that caveat is something that you would consider acquiescing to.
Yes and no. I mean, what I was trying to say was that what the European allies and friends of the US, who are by no means without power, could practice that type of Gandhian civil disobedience. It would also mean a stepping up, an intensification from today of trading and cooperating in all fields with Iran. Just say we are no longer going to take orders. I mean, when the US ambassador to Germany tells Germany to stop having any relationship with Germany.
Unbelievable.
I think that should be a limit to anybody in Europe, however much they may love the US as a country, as a culture, as a society. There is something called a red line to how far friends should accept to be bullied.
This was tantamount to a diktat from a Roman proconsul, wasn't it? To one of his one of its client states.
Yeah, you can say so, but I mean that's where I'm kind of looking for the moment when somebody in Europe, and I'm afraid we do not have the type of statesmen in Europe that we had before, whether Willy Brandt or Bruno Kreisky or Olof Palme or others who dared stand up to the U.S. and do something else, such as Willy Brandt did with his Ostpolitik and Detentpolitik and his kneeling down at the war memorial in Warsaw and all that. We do not have that type of people with civil courage, with experience, with passion and with ethics that we had before. And that's where you know, sometimes we have in a very deep crisis situation to also wish for something to happen and inspire each other. And that's why I say we cannot conquer the United States. We cannot force them to do something else. We can only do it if we are friends of the U.S. And of course, NATO and EU countries are and consider themselves friends, maybe not of Trump or Washington, but of the U.S. as a society. That is my hope, that somebody will stand up and say, this is as far as we will accept it. We are not only staying with an agreement. We are going to implement the agreement with Iran because we are honest people, because we respect Iran, and because we do not want a war with Iran. It should be declared now by European leaders, for instance, that no matter what you're going to do in the Middle East, we're not following you with more military activities. You will go out alone with Israel or whoever, but you'll not have any NATO member with you. I actually think Erdogan is doing the right thing. However, he's not a man I usually speak positively about. But having withdrawn his ambassadors and say, you know, enough is enough, and I'm not going to accept this policy. He has special reasons for doing that, and it's not Gandhianism, of course. But what I'm saying is we need now a benign civil disobedience campaign from among the friends and allies of the United States. Because if that does not work out now, we will all be bowing down, submissive to what would be, you know, a terrible period of decay and fall of the U.S. empire, and contrary to the fall of the Soviet Union, there is no Gorbachev in the Western world. There's no man with a strategic vision for a better world. There's nobody in the West who would not use weapons in Washington, too. We were very lucky to have Mikhail Gorbachev at the time when that system broke down, and he had a vision of Europe as a house of peace. Today, we don't have anybody of that caliber in the West, and that's what actually frightens me more than anything else. The U.S. empire will go down, but hopefully with a whimper and not with a bang, because a bang means, you know, major warfare. Indeed. Again, or third world war on nuclear weapons.
We're certainly in a very, very dangerous period. Another point I'd like to explore that you make in your article forcefully Again, one which I completely concur with, is that you state that more countries, and I'm quoting you now, more countries should now decide to trade oil in other currencies than the US dollar. For this, Jan gets to the heart of the matter, because US power really rests on foundations of sand. It's based on the hegemony of the dollar and the role of Wall Street in sucking up all the world's surplus capital, which it recycles as debt. So it's a very, very precarious economic model that underpins US gargantuan power and the US empire. And do you see any potential for the EU to act as a counterweight, and including the euro as a counter in terms of an international reserve currency? I know that was muted at the time of the EU, when the EU was introduced. Obviously, we've had the euro crisis since then, and the EU is not the political bloc that its supporters would like it to be. And it certainly looks a long way from moving in that direction, given what's been going on recently with the advent of the global economic crash of 2008 and how it's given succour to centrifugal forces throughout the EU, Brexit, of course, but the rise of the right, mostly the right, in terms of those centrifugal political forces. But do you see the EU, do you have hope in the EU can be reformed, and in the slipstream of this crisis, that there will be an awakening across Europe as to the nature of the transatlantic alliance, and that Europe will now have to forge its own path as an independent geopolitical and economic entity?
Now, if you look at all the resources of Europe, if they could get their act together, which they cannot, not even according to the Treaty of Lisbon, but if they could, they have a formidable strength in the civilian spheres of politics, culture, and economy. I'm not in doubt that it is possible. The question is whether you have the leadership to make them speak with one voice, which is what the EU should be about originally and according to the treaty. Now, when it comes to the currency issue, I wrote what I wrote because the U.S. Treasury is harassing everybody who tries to deal with Iran. You know, for a nanosecond, most of the exchanges between currencies when Iran is paying Europe or whatever is passing through the dollar. And the moment that happens, the U.S. insists on putting up sanctions and punishing companies and banks in Europe if they trade with Iran. And that's my point, simply that then if that is so, the West has to stand up and say, we're going to do it anyhow. And then you might say, well, there's five banks or three companies that violate these rules of the U.S. Treasury. No, but if 300 or 3,000 or 30,000 companies and banks in Europe begin to trade with the legal system of the United States cannot pursue all these cases. It's, again, Gandhian thinking. You have to have a mass movement with a moral strength to do it. We do it together, and we do it enough of us to do it. And that's what I believe, you know, I mean, of course, with China coming up, with the Silk Road being built, et cetera, I mean, the dollar is not going to be the world's exchange currency in the long run, or reserve currency in the long run. The U.S. is heading for a decay in many ways, and the best they could do now in their own interest would be to accept history's fate. Fate is that all empires go down, and this will be the last in human history. Nobody, no single country will try in the future to dominate the rest of the world. The U.S. empire will be the last classical empire, if you will, or whatever we would call it, structure of that type, where one country is trying to, you know, dominate 7.5 billion people's lives. And we will have a much more cooperative, multipolar world, which I find fascinating. I'm very much of an optimist in the long run. I believe in humanity's ability to change things. But we have some very tough years in front of us because of the United States empire, not because of the U.S. society, but because of the empire, the global dominance wish, which is embedded in, very clearly written in, their national security strategy and their nuclear policies. Everybody can see it. It's just not discussed in the media. There's no excuse for not knowing it, because they are honest enough to write it very clearly to everyone. This is what we want. We want full spectrum dominance of the world.
Yeah, 800 military bases in 70 countries around the world tells its own stories, doesn't it, in terms of...
Yeah, well, as you see, it's also financial transactions, and it's also moral power, telling others not to trade with Iran because they don't want to do it themselves, etc. My solidarity in this situation is totally with the Iranian people. It's not about governments here and there. It's about the...
That's a key point.
Of more suffering of the Iranian people because of these sanctions in 79.
That's a key point, Jan, because I want to come on to that. My solidarity with the Iranians, with the Syrian people and its government at this point, the Cubans, Venezuelans and North Koreans, is total. Let me tell you why. the internal development of any given state is inextricably linked to the external pressures it faces and are being placed against it. Imperialism exerts inordinate pressure on the development of those countries. In fact, it impedes it, it interrupts it, it discombobulates it. And so the analogy I would use, Jan, is when people in the West, people on the left and people who are in the peace movement, so-called, attack Syria, attack Iran for, in their eyes, the regressive nature of its internal institutions, democracy and so forth, the human rights. The analogy I would use is this. If somebody squeezes your neck and then berates you for not being able to breathe properly, what kind of person is that? That is the analogy I would use for the pressure that imperialism exerts on these countries. And so it behooves anyone with any understanding how this dynamic operates to offer total support for the Iranian people at this point in their history so that we can get that hand removed from the neck of Iran so that it can start to breathe properly and breathe as we breathe. But the problem I have, Jan, is that there does not seem to be any move in the US. I think the US is going through its own internal crisis. And I think you're right, it's going to have to get worse before it gets better. Do you see any vision? Do you see, for example, any hope in someone, say, like Bernie Sanders, who rose to prominence in 2016? Do you see that as the first shoots of hope for the US for a new path?
No, I don't really. I mean, I'm not saying they're not good leaders, but the people who are thinking new thoughts today, they don't join politics. Politics have become, you know, instead of a democracy, it's become more of a what you know, the word kakistocracy. It means to rule by the least able and the least moral people instead of, you know, the opposite of aristocracy if you use the Greek background. I think, I mean, politics in the Western world, and that's also why we have a democracy crisis, has degenerated into deal and wheel and horse trading and career politics, and the intellectual level of what we do in the West is lower than I can remember the 40 years plus that I've been working with these issues, including, you know, people who don't know what a nuclear weapons is, don't know what, you know, the doctrines are about, don't know the basic security theories. We have very few politicians writing good books anymore. We have before. So, I mean, this whole thing that change should come from the politician, I don't believe in that. I always believe that change will come from through public education, through engagement in civil society at various levels, and that it's the people who finally, you know, change the world. Together with, in some cases, actually corporations. If you look at what stopped the Vietnam War, it was very much, you know, people like Daniel Ellsberg and the anti-war Vietnam movement and all that. But it was certainly also stopping the moment the corporations told the administration in Washington that this is not beneficial economically. This war costs too much. And I think, you know, they're digging their own grave in Washington, all these companies belonging to the civil society. The only ones who really benefit from warfare are those which are part of the military industrial media academic complex, MIMAC, as I called it, because they earn money on weapons and destruction. The rest of the economy is paying a huge price.
Wonderful, Jan. Thank you very much for your insights. Let me just leave you with the sage words of Oscar Wilde. America is the only country that went from barbarism to decadence without civilization in between. I think we can amend that to say that America is the only country that went from barbarism to decadence, then back to barbarism without civilization in between. You've been listening to Jan Oberg. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.